Amen. All right. My name is Matt Williams, and I have the opportunity to be leading the teaching portion of our worship services on all of our campuses this weekend. It is good to see you, and I know because of the nature of this weekend at this point in the fall that there is elation and there is grieving, and there are some of your teams that had near misses and some got toppled. And I know if you're from other parts of the country, other parts of the world, you think, what is their fascination with football? Well, let me just explain something to you. Is that we're predominantly an ACC area, so we are much holier than those of the SEC. So I have friends who pastor in Georgia, Alabama, Tennessee, Mississippi, Texas, Louisiana, and they're way worse off than we are. Like, they can't even acknowledge it. So this is a few moments to gather yourself, humble yourself, recognize that's one form of idolatry. You got to turn from it, right? Before we jump in, let me share with you, we have our teaching app that a lot of you have on your phone. I no longer have this because my 5 crashed, so now I'm using a Dixie cup with a string hanging from it. So people are texting me like, hey, I really need you to, and I'm like, who is this? Because I don't know who it is anymore. But if you happen to have a phone, right, you get the texting, the Bible app. One of the things that we've added that I'm supposed to talk about that's important is what we're calling Bible Insights. So when you go to the app, you go to resources. One of the, I think, 3 choices there is Bible Insights. And we've put together 3 or so short videos. I think we upload another one this weekend just to help you in studying the scriptures. Here's some insights that would be helpful to you as you study, about how to study, what to look for. We're pretty excited about that. The way we're studying, thinking about the scriptures, how we have it with us all the time, where do we study, how do we study, that is dramatically changing, and we want to meet that need and create resources so that you'd be equipped. So we're excited about that. Grab your Bible, turn to Esther chapter 4, somewhere around 300, I think. If you don't have a Bible, there's one in the seat or the pew or being handed out at Anderson or Spartanburg or wherever you happen to be. Just grab one of those Bibles, about page 300. If you got a different Bible, just look it up in the thing in the front. Can't remember what it's called. Just a quick recap before we look at chapter 4. Chapter 1, we meet Xerxes, most powerful leader in the world. We see an argument between him and his wife. They split apart. He has her banished. But then he realizes over the course of a few years, I really miss having a wife. So he puts together a plan with his brilliant brain trust on how to get another one. In chapter 2, In comes, in addition to the story, Mordecai and Esther. They come on the scene. We find that Esther is quite beautiful and she's quite winsome. Mordecai has been her caretaker. We find at the end of the chapter that there is a plot against Xerxes that Mordecai finds out, tells Esther. Esther relates to the king. The plot is foiled. That begins a stage to elevate these two folks. So you have the king, Xerxes, and you have Esther up here as these parallels. Underneath them being raised up are 2 new characters, Mordecai, who we've met briefly, but it'll become a larger part of the story, and Haman gets elevated, as we saw last week. So then you have those 2 layers of people in proximity to each other. Haman gets elevated. He and Mordecai have conflict. They represent nations, as it turns out. They've never gotten along. So Mordecai won't tremble in his presence. Haman's frustrated by that. We get to diagnose that kind of pride in the next few weeks. It creates some tension. Haman initiates a plan to exterminate not just Mordecai, but all the Jews. So genocide is on the way. Here's what's interesting about this kind of genocide. The armies are not going to handle it. This is not going to be turned over to the professionals. This is going to be hand-to-hand in the towns. So you live next door to these Jews, you go kill them, you get everything they got. It's an interesting incentive plan, and it's a way to wipe this group of people out, and you don't have to mobilize a big army. So as we get to this point, right at chapter 4, we're left with, how come there's no God helping? Like, where is God? As we meet our most desperate hour, God is nowhere to be found. Yet we're arguing along the sidelines. We're screaming out, God is directing everything. He's still in control. We're going to find out a couple things in this chapter and going forward that are a little disconcerting, that God is directing. He wants to use us, and we are eminently expendable. We are consumable. As Bill White said last week when he was introducing communion, that Jesus came to be a consumable for us. He came to be expendable, something that you could take, that you could acquire, that his life, that his righteousness would be expended on you, that the wrath that was meant for you would be absorbed in his body. He would be an exchange agent with you, and so his righteousness would come to you, your sin would come to him, and thus you'd have life and he'd have death. And so he becomes consumed by God's wrath for us. It's an interesting idea. And here's what we'll see. We'll see in this passage and in some New Testament corollaries that is not far from what God wants for us too. Right? It's a difficult thing to think about, but we've got to wade into it. So Esther chapter 4, verse 1. When Mordecai learned about all that had been done, which is this edict that says we're going to kill all the Jews. When he learns about that, he tore his clothes, he put on burlap and ashes, and went out into the city crying with a loud and bitter wail. So there's this physical display. He went as far as the gate of the palace, for no one was allowed to enter the gate of the palace while wearing mourning clothes. You cannot go into the king's presence or close to him when presenting that things aren't great in the world, because that would be a reflection on him, since he's probably part deity and probably runs the world, and this is his kingdom. Verse 3, as the news of the king's decree reached all the provinces, there was great mourning among the Jews. So he's mourning and the nation's mourning. They fasted, they wept, they wailed, and all the people lay in burlap and ashes. Now when he says, this is interesting, they fasted, they wept, they wailed, burlap, moaning. What are they doing? But what gets left out? Prayer. Because if you're going to pray, who would you be praying to? God. I mean, the author's been very intentional to make sure that we don't mention God and we don't mention the things that connect us to him. It's a unique design in this book. Don't dismiss the visible displays of mourning. Because we see the Pharisees do it in the New Testament, we write it off. We're like, well, that's just outward and their heart's far from God. Right. But there are times when your heart is broken, or your heart is in need of something, and your body can reflect that. There can be a physical display or outworking of it. So that it's fine, right? It's actually a good thing. In verse 4, just recap, Esther's maids see what's going on with Mordecai. They tell her, Esther what's going on, and she says, well, he shouldn't be mourning, so she sends him some new clothes, which he refuses. He is a stubborn individual. Like, he gets clarity around a couple ideas, and you're not going to move him or change his mind. So she sends clothes to him, says, you shouldn't be mourning. Take that burlap off. Put these nice clothes on. He won't do it. And then she says, find out to her servants, find out why he's mourning. Find out why he's so upset. Is that ironic? A little bit. That she's married to the king who's made an edict that she's not aware of. He is out in the nation living life, and he is aware, and she's not. She's closer to the king where that decision was made. It's an interesting idea. Verse 7. Mordecai told her servant the whole story, including the exact amount of money that Haman had promised to pay into the royal treasury for the destruction of the Jews. Told him the whole story. Mordecai gave Hatak a copy of the decree issued in Susa and called for the death of all the Jews. Hatak, he said, you show it to Esther and explain the situation to her. Notice he's giving direction. You take this piece of paper to her and you explain to her what's happening so she can know it. Yes, but so she can do something about it. She's the queen. He also asked Hatak to direct her to go to the king and beg for mercy and plead for her people. So Hatak returned to Esther with Mordecai's message. So he takes an active role now and begins to give the servant direction, to give her direction. The assumption being, I know she's queen, but she's Jewish. I raised her. Hopefully she'll hear these words. Here's what I think is most interesting. There's about three things in this passage, really two, that should stand out. This is one of them. Is that notice right there at the end of that little section, right before verse 9. Go to the king and beg for mercy and plead for what? For whose people? For her people. Now, up to this point, don't tell them who you are. Do not tell them who you are. Now, Mordecai has let everybody know, because he got into a little thing, a little male conflict, right? A little ego. He got in, for right or wrong. And so he's let people know, but he's had her hide that. Now he says, you need to plead for your people. And here's the place, and I don't want to overstate this, but it seems to be that this is something that's starting to arise. No longer is this a safe place for us. No longer is this a place where we can fit in. Now, God would have said in the beginning, that's not a safe place for you. Don't try to fit in there. And what they said was, you know, I think we can make this our home. God said, don't make that your home. And they said, I think we can make this our home. I think we can make this a safe place. I think this could work for us. I think if we keep quiet about who we are, I think if we try to fit in, I think we can make this a safe place. Even though this is not what God said, maybe we can make this work for us. They've fallen in love with the culture instead of staying pure and rallied around God's principles, like you see with Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They rallied around God's principles, put themselves in harm's way, but they didn't fall in love with the culture. Apparently, this group has fallen in love with the culture, and now Mordecai's real clear. That's not going well for us. We tried to work it out with the culture, and now we're going to have to separate. We're going to have to get clear. We made this place our home. They've been disregarding. I'll tell you an interesting another place in the scriptures when this happens. There's a few, but there's one in Acts, the book of Acts, when Jesus says, go wait, and then here's the deal. In Acts 1:8, you're going to go into Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and the uttermost part of the earth. And do they do that? They do not. It's not until they get persecuted that they say, you know, I think it's time to obey Jesus. I think we'll start doing what Jesus tells us to do. But when he said go, they did not go because they were rallied and it's a safe place for them. And then when it no longer becomes a safe place, then they're actually going to obey. And so this is true for me. It's true for you. Some of the best decisions in my life come off the heels of the worst season. When something in my life has run its course and the idolatry has been exposed for what it is, when the self-seeking has been exposed for what it is, when the selfishness and the pride and then the Matt's agenda has run its course and it's clear now that that didn't work out, then I'm like, oh, you know what? I guess I'll follow God now. This would be a great idea. I got a great idea. I think I'll start doing what he told me to do to begin with. So many people in our church, so many of you, the dream collapsed. The idolatry turned to dust in your hands. And you thought, I can't trust this anymore. I can't make that career my home. I can't make that relationship my home. I can't make this world my home. I got to go in a different direction now. This, what I was building was actually a castle, but it was a castle of sand and it just got wiped out. And so now I got to go in a different direction and maybe this is what God has for me. And so when the dream collapsed, the idol just folded up, then you thought, oh, I'm gonna move in a new direction. Some of that may be what's happening here. Verse 10. Then Esther, she told Hatak to go back and relay this message to Mordecai. Because he said what? Go to the king and beg for help. Go help us. Help your people. Which means you got to tell them who you are and you got to ask for help. Verse 11, all the king's officials, even the people in the provinces, know that anyone who appears before the king in his inner court without being invited is doomed to die unless he holds out the gold scepter. She's like, you got to understand something. You don't just walk in. You walk in, you die. Now, there's something that he can do to stop you from dying, but if he doesn't take action to stop you from dying, the momentum, the system's already set up. You go in, you get killed. This is what happens. And if he doesn't take action, then you'll die. I mean, you are going, it's not like you walk in, he's like, I don't want to see her, kill her. He doesn't have to do that. He didn't have to do anything. You walk in, you die. Now, if he notices you and wants to step into the moment and take judgment off of you, he can do that. But he doesn't have to. And she says, it's kind of sarcasm. She's like, all the king's officials, even the people in the provinces, the people above you and the people below you, they all know this rule. Why are you telling me to do this? He goes, and then the king has not called for me in 30 days. What's her point? Well, first of all, they need the one series because there's no way to cultivate intimacy. You're going to be not together for 30 days. I'm no counselor. I'm just an observation. She goes, I can't go see him. He has not called for me. I'm not on the brain. He ain't thinking about me. He got other stuff going on. What's her point? Her point is, my hands are tied. Her point is, I'm not a player. And if I wanted to be a player, I can't get in the door. So I'm not a player. He hadn't called for me. I'm not involved. I didn't even know the edict was given. You knew the edict was given. I didn't know. I wasn't involved in that. He doesn't consult me in all this. We hadn't talked in 30 days. I have not seen him. There's nothing for me to do here, and there's no way for me to get my foot in the door. Is she making a good point? She's making a really good point. Is she lying? No, she's not lying. She's telling the truth. So at this point, when you're thinking about your daughter, your niece, your young sister, your young cousin, all of which would fit into that category for him, this young lady that you raised, that you spent your whole life providing for her, protecting her, caring for her, just sacrificing for her, that's what you do. You would expect a tremendous amount of sympathy towards her. You're in a tight spot. He hadn't called for you in 30 days. You could risk your life if you were to go see him. So let's hear his sympathy in verse 13. Mordecai sent this reply to Esther. Don't think for a moment that because you are in the palace, you will escape when all other Jews are killed. He goes, let's get this straight. Let me make sure you understand something. He goes, now, are you trying to distance yourself from your people? Is that what you're trying to do? Like now that it's all falling apart and it's all hit the fan and we don't know what's going to happen, are you trying to hold up in the palace as a queen as if you are not Jewish? Let me ask this question again another way. Are you going to trust in your status as a queen, one of the highest ranking officials in the nation, in the world, pretty high status? You think you could trust in that, wouldn't you? His point is, do you think that you can trust in your earthly, worldly status as a queen? Do you think that you can do that and put distance between you and your condition as a Jew? He says, do not fool yourself. There is nothing in this world that stable. There is no way that you can, through your status, acquire true safety, true security, true stability. Don't think for a moment that because you're in the palace, your status, that you won't go down with the rest of us. Bill said at the end of his sermon last week, do not trust in your resources. Do not think that you can pull together resources to make life work for yourself. It is only an illusion. You are queen, one of the highest ranking humans walking the earth. Mordecai says, it's not going to mean anything. Anything earthly can fall apart at any given time. There's nothing you can do about that. And his hidden point, which he'll get clear on, and she gets real clear on it, is that nobody's getting out alive. Don't think that your condition as a Jew will not supersede your status. Your status can't override that condition. A parallel is just in life. It's just your brokenness in life is your condition. There's no status you can acquire to override that. Or God's judgment against you and your sinful nature. There's no status you can acquire to override that. Your status can't override your condition. This is her condition. When I was 19 years old, my dad had his first brain surgery. So he had another one when I was 30, and then it came back last year, and he lived with us in Greenville and had radiation on it. But then when I was 19, I was a freshman at Clemson, and he had this brain tumor, and I went, got up real early. Everybody else was staying in Greenville because they were coming from the coast and some from up in the upstate, but I was at Clemson. I got up and drove early, got to the hospital room. He was sitting on the end of the bed, and everybody went out for some reason. It was just the two of us. It's probably 6:30 in the morning. Just two of us. He's sitting on the end of the bed, and I'm sitting in this chair, and I'm picking on him because he's putting on those compression hose. And I'm like, you do look good in those. And so he's like, I'm going to choke you with one of these things. And so, and we're sitting there talking, and you don't want a 19-year-old with you in the hospital room when you're going into life and death kind of surgery because there's not a lot of social awareness. And so I said, I have a terrible feeling about this. Imagine how that makes you feel. I was like, I have a terrible feeling. I'm afraid this isn't going to, who signs up for a 10 to 12 hour surgery? What can 12 hours of surgery, how can this be? And I said, we should call this off. Let's just call it a day. We're good. Let's figure out. There's other options. Let's figure something else out. And he looked at me. I'll never forget this. He looked at me while he's putting on his white pantyhose and he stopped and he goes, you got to remember something. I'm already a dead man. He goes, I don't have a ton of options. He goes, as it is now, I'm not going to make it. This is my opportunity. This is it. This is what I got. He goes, and we're going to trust God with that. And I mean, and that was a dark cloud and a dark reality for me to try to process, especially as such a young man. But there is a spiritual truth here that you see in Esther that does apply to how you and I think and live. And it goes all across the Christian life. It's a thinking, a kind of thinking that plays a role in how the Christian life is lived. Romans 6:11 reads like this. He goes, "So you also should consider yourselves to be dead to the power of sin and alive to God through Christ Jesus." Now, he's not talking about a daily issue necessarily that's petty, but then it could be. Consider yourselves dead to the power of sin and alive to God through Jesus Christ. There's this part of consider yourself dead, reckon yourself dead, because in death comes a unique kind of freedom. So as long as Esther holds on to her life as queen, she's no good to these Jews, and ultimately no good to herself, and no good to God's agenda. But once she reckons herself dead, now she's free to make some real decisions that can have influence and impact. Once you consider yourself dead, then you're free to obey. When you consider yourself dead to this way of living, then you're free to do some hard things in life. Because those hard things just are real, they're too much sacrifice and too much weight, and I don't want to do that. But when you consider yourself dead to your opportunity in your life, then these hard things aren't so hard anymore. Not as complicated in that sense. When you consider yourself dead, you're free to look at your path and the future that it leads you to and then cross it out and be like, yeah, that's not where I'm going. That's not what I want to do. That's not the life that I want. I'm headed in a different direction. Dead to your old life creates some freedom to develop new passions. And this is the idea. Not necessarily new disciplines. The disciplines come. New passions, new desires, and new loves. Once we're dead to something that's destructive, then we're free to develop some new loves, some new passions. So when Augustine says, you become what you love, it's because you got to die to something else for that freedom to be there. 14. We'll come back to it. I know that's a heavy load. We'll come back. 14. If you keep quiet at a time like this, deliverance and relief for the Jews will arise from some other place, but you and your relatives will die. He goes, if you keep quiet, if you stay out, just know God can and will bring about deliverance, but it just may not be what we'd all hoped. Now, we said this the first week, and it's why I took our time and said, let's just set some foundation, not the most exciting first two chapters, but we talked about God's sovereignty that first week. What does it mean for God to be sovereign? And trust me, I got emails because it is uncomfortable. For some of you who are thinking about what does it mean for God to be sovereign, it raises some tremendous questions about what's called free will, which obviously nobody has free will. God didn't have free will. He can't lie, right? I mean, we're all bound by something, so our will is not inherently free. So the sovereignty of God, to be clear on this, obedience is not a requirement for God's sovereignty. It is not a necessity for God to be effectual in what he's doing. He can take your rebellion, he can take your obedience, he can accomplish what he wants. This is disturbing right here because the way God was presented to me was he needed me to obey. He was sitting on pins and needles like my needy prom date that I couldn't get anybody else to go with me, but I had her in my back pocket so I could just go by at the last minute, pick her up. That's the way God was presented to me. So needy, whenever I'm ready, he'll take me. I didn't have a needy prom date, okay? I didn't have anybody in my back pocket. It's just kind of an illustration, okay? Trust me, I have much of anything, right? This idea that God is needy and waiting. God wants you. He desires. And it's in my best interest to obey. But his sovereignty, his power over his creation is so great, he does not need my obedience or hers. He can accomplish what he wants, when he wants, how he wants. My obedience is something that he desires, but it's even in my best interest to obey. Even if it doesn't go well for me in the short term. Even if I were to lose my life, to be caught up in what he's doing is a better thing. And then this most famous phrase for the whole book that everybody loves to talk about, and rightfully so. Last phrase in 14. And who knows? See that language? Not God. Who knows? Who knows what can happen? It's intentionally moving, drawing attention to who God is by looking in the other direction. And who knows if perhaps you were made queen for such a time as this. He goes, now let's think about it. How random is this royal couple? How random is the argument? How random is the banishment? How random is the acquisition of all these young ladies? How random it is that you rose to the top? How random that you were made the queen? How random that all these events with Mordecai have taken place? How random that we find ourselves in this moment where you are a queen who happens to be a Jew, and now there's a plan to exterminate all the Jews. How random? And perhaps this is what God has been doing all along. Who knows if perhaps you were made queen? Made by who? This is the strongest allusion we have to God. Who knows if perhaps you were made queen, that you were appointed to this? And here's the underbelly of the idea. Just stop and just think for just a second, right? The presuppositions that this idea, that statement stands on. Maybe you being queen is not about you being queen. It's a fascinating idea. Maybe you being famous, not about you being famous. Maybe you being wealthy, not about you being wealthy. Maybe you being powerful, not about you being powerful. Maybe you being smart is not about you being smart. Maybe you were appointed to this. Maybe the story that has taken a turn for the better in your life, maybe your story, maybe it's not even actually yours. Maybe this is God's story and you've been drawn into it and he's wanting to use you to do something. And maybe your queenship, your highness, is to be leveraged. Maybe everything that has happened up to this point in your life is to get you here to be leveraged, not for your own benefit, but so that you could further the program of God on the earth in this moment. It raises wonderful questions about what's going on with us. You're like, well, I'm not famous, rich, powerful, smart. I got none of that. That's not even the point. Neither was she. Right? And it's all illusion anyway. He's like, you think being the palace is going to be a big deal for you? You think that's going to go well for you? God's saying. He goes, it's all an illusion anyway. Whatever you have, whatever beauty, whatever smarts, whatever power you have, whatever money you have saved up, it's all an illusion anyway. But maybe it's here for a certain time as leverage. So your life's not about you. Your career's not about you. Your family, oh, in the suburbs, how precious is family? I get emails every year, family's the most important thing ever. Actually, it's not. There is something that transcends, right in front of us, that transcends family. It's called church. I mean, my kids are going to grow up. They're going to move on. They're going to need community, teaching, instruction that goes beyond what my family can do. What about my original family? They can give me nothing. They can care for me. Not at all now. They can't take care of me. I got to have a local church that can take care of me. I mean, there are tons of things more important in the world than a lot of the things that are good that we elevate to a place that are unhealthy. So family is important, not the most important thing. My career, my life, my family, my money, my house, my car, and my fulfillment. Obviously, God wants me to be fulfilled. Well, depends on how you define fulfillment. If it means living a long time and having everything you want and everything go your way, I can assure you that is not what God is thinking about. And I was told he was, and then I had to find out the hard way that that is not what he's thinking about. For her to be able to sacrifice for others, to lose comfort, seems to be exactly what God is thinking about. Verse 15, these last couple verses. This is interesting. When Esther sent this reply to Mordecai, you're like, well, maybe that's not what he's saying. Maybe he's not being as strong with this young lady as it looks like he is. 16, go and gather together all the Jews, this is what she says, of Susa, and fast for me. Don't eat and drink for 3 days, night or day, which is not just daytime fast, day and night. Now notice, did she mention prayer? She did not. My maids and I will do the same. And then, though it is against the law, I'm going to go break the law, but I'm willing to take the consequences. I will go and see the king. Notice the next phrase. What's the next phrase? And if I must die, I what? I must die. So she's pretty clear on what he's saying. Like, well, maybe he's not really meaning that. She's picked up on what he's saying. So who, what man tells his daughter, hey, you're going to have to die. You're going to have to be willing to die. I mean, that is just a unique thought that I hardly ever hear anybody talk about when you have this book, but when you teach this book, because it seems so counter to everything we believe in our culture, that everything should be directed towards me rather than it should be directed towards God. He goes, you might have to die in this process. There's worse things than giving up your life for what God wants done in the world. So Mordecai went away and did everything that Esther had ordered him. So he's given her direction. She's given him direction. They're coming together on this thing. She's clear. I must die. This could be the end of her. There's a unique freedom that comes. And let me just say, we're teaching some material for the middle age of students. So if you've got that first age that goes 0 up to 6, 7 years old, then this another age that starts at 6, 7, 8 goes up through kind of preteens. That is the age that we're working on right now, where we're seeing this kind of issue come to bear the most, is that we are creating a whole generation of young people who are arrogant, lazy, weak, cannot take responsibility, cannot handle things. They don't receive any pressure down. As a parent, there's a certain amount of pressure that we're supposed to put down on our children, not for performance sake, but for the development of their character. And you go, well, that can go too far, like the World War II generation? Maybe. We don't even know what all that was. But there's a certain pressure that needs to go down to help shape and develop their character. And so he is clear that there's a cause worthy that might cost us, so he's willing to put that pressure down. Doesn't matter, boy or girl, right? My girl, I got 4 girls, princess time. There is time to be princess, but there's also time you got to clean, you got to work, you got to do this, you got to sacrifice, you got to serve. It's a good thing. Let me show you some New Testament references that highlight this idea. Jesus says this in John 10:18. No one can take my life from me, which is this allusion to the idea that who's in control? God is. It looks like someone took his life from him. He goes, God is ultimately in control of that. Which does what? That kind of sovereignty thinking frees you up to make some tough decisions. If God's really in control, it frees me up to make some decisions. I sacrifice it voluntarily, for I have the authority to lay it down, and when I want, also to take it up again. So look, I got this voluntary, this authority thing. He goes, for this is what my Father has commanded. I'm like, well, which one is it? God's commanded it. I voluntarily do it. I have authority. Yes. Welcome to the discussion on how this works. People say, well, I'm believing God's sovereignty and I believe in all his free will. Like, yes. We got no answers for how this works together. But notice the big ideas. He goes, part of what God has planned is that I would sacrifice my life for other people. I'm going to sacrifice my life. That's the agenda here, is to be able to lay it down for other people. Then in Matthew 10, talking about us. He goes, if you cling to your life, you'll lose it. But if you give it up, if you give up your life for me, you will find it. You're like, well, surely it's a kind of a meta. He's not talking about actually dying. He's talking about probably how you live on a daily basis. Okay, take your pick, right? He's talking about both, right? And he certainly is. It has implications for both, applications for both. But either way, it's not like you're helping yourself when you say, oh, he's talking about this, he's not talking about this. Either way is incredibly challenging. The point being, cling to your life, you'll lose it. But if you give up your life for me, you'll find it. So there's this future hope and future comfort. But here's the thing, give up your life. It may not go well in the short run. That's Christianity. Things may not go well for us in the short term. And I don't know what happened in our churches where we thought we've got to sell people the American dream so that they'll believe in Christianity and then we can feel validated as a group of people when more people come in because we're telling them. And it's hard sometimes to tell the difference when a preacher's talking about the gospel and when a politician's talking about the American dream. I'm like, gosh, those sound exactly the same. But when Jesus talks about the gospel, it doesn't sound at all like an American politician talking about future hope and things are going to get better and a chicken in every pot and you're going to get this and you're going to do that. Right? I mean, there's all this hope in the future and it's all going to go great and you're going to do this and all these great things are going to happen. That's an American dream. This is, you're going to obey God and things may get terribly worse, but it's okay because there is a future hope. But a lot of the promise, these two things are woven together so tightly, it's gotten a little weird. And Paul says this is the best. 2 Tim 4:6. He goes, as for me, this is the last thing that he writes at the end of his life. As for me, my life has already been poured out as an offering to God. The time of my death is near. Now here's what's cool. There are times when you give up your life because you're at a crossroads and your life gets sacrificed for the gospel. But for him, he's been doing it through his life. His life, he is at the end of his life, but his life up to this point has been an offering to God. It's been poured out like a drink offering that would get poured out on the altar. His life, the daily, the way he woke up in the morning, the way he lived, the way he sacrificed, the way he served, the way he responded. His life was a sacrifice to be honoring to God and a blessing to others, to be a part of what God was doing. So if you said, you know what? I don't know how I would respond if I was Esther. That's obviously true. I have no idea how I would respond. If Mordecai said, hey, you got to go see the king. You might just have to die. Like, I wouldn't be so bold to say, well, I know that I've prayed about it and I'd be great with that. I have no idea, right? And the good news is we're not facing a lot of that right now. But here's what we can do. We can start with the little things. Instead of worrying about how the big thing would go, let's worry about some of the little things. Some of us will not share our life with another person about who God is to us and what he's done for us. That is complete Sunday talk for us. That is complete weekend religion. During the week, we're a different person because we don't want to carry the stigma of being associated with God. We want what religion has for us on the weekend, and then we want what the world has during the week. We're not willing to go on the hook and associate with God and with his people and with Jesus, and so we're not willing to share our life. And so we're not caught up in the middle of what God's doing. Some of us won't serve because our time is so precious. We got these cool things we want to do, and we've forgotten God's the one who made you the queen. And you're enjoying being a queen so much, you're forgetting that he wanted you to use being the queen to affect change and to advance his kingdom in the world. You're like, I love being queen. I love being the king. I love this great opportunity he's given me, and I'm going to wear it out. And you're forgetting that you're so consumed doing that you haven't turned back and said, oh, he wants me to use this. Some of us, our sin is wearing us out. And we will not step forward and just own that and confess because we don't want to lose our reputation. We will not say, I am addicted to this. This is destroying me. And just be honest and say, this is who I am. This is what God needs to do in my life. And I need to be a part of community. Some of us, we won't give of our resources. We're like, God's given me all this money and I like it. I like keeping it for me. God will give you the queenship. He will make you queen so that you can leverage it for other people. So being queen is not necessarily being queen for you. It's being queen for others. And so your money, some of your money was given to you to use for you. Some of your money was given to you to use for other people, to use for his kingdom, to be able to invest in his kingdom. And so you can take it all into yourself. You're consuming the very gifts that he gave us to leverage. Some of us, you have no cause bigger than yourself. You got to find a cause. Maybe it's within the church. Maybe it's in the community. You got to find a cause that's bigger than you where you can lay your life down because all of your energy is turned in towards yourself. What can bless me? What can care for me? What can promote me? What can make my life better? Rather than saying, here's a cause that I'm going to bleed out for. This may be difficult, but I'm going to do it anyway. I'm going to pray and we're going to sing together. I'm going to leave you with these two thoughts. Your value comes in serving him. You're like, well, my value, I'm gospel-centered. And my value comes in the fact that I was created in the image of God and Jesus died for me. That's gospel-centered. Here's the thing. But you never acknowledge that if you don't turn your life over to him. So you can say that all day long, but those are just words until you lay your life back down for him. Then you're acknowledging, I actually do believe all that. I actually do believe it. So your real value in who you are as his servant comes in the way that you serve him and you sacrifice and you give your life to him. And then your comfort, later. It doesn't come now. And there are times when I get through a hard season, 5 children, church has been demanding. I get to a season, I'm like, I need a break. And that's fine. You go through seasons that are hard and then you do need a break. But you got to be careful. The promise is that comfort comes later, not now. It may not be for us right now. Let's pray. Father, as you continue to introduce tension into us, that we would remember that this is the tension that you had with your son when you turned him over to the Jews and to the Romans. That this is the tension that your son had in the garden when he made peace with the idea that he would be sacrificed for the sins of the world. This is the tension that he felt hanging on the cross, dying for us. And Father, though we put our faith and our trust in you and we have salvation and you have approved of us, we do not have to work to earn your grace and your mercy and your favor. You have granted it to us freely. But now that brings about a change deep inside of us that should cause us in gratitude with new desires and a new heart and new drives and new motivations and new passions to want to give our lives back to you to be poured out like a drink offering. Would you continue to be gracious and patient with us and lead us to a place where we see ourselves clearly and the mercy that you have for us and how it can change us? We ask it in your name.